It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, precision medicine is being used for experimental cancer treatments that are getting a lot of excitement in the medical community and the media. But it's expensive and it doesn't always live up to expectations. A health reporter gives us the details coming up. First, the landmark deal between Governor Walker's administration and Taiwan-based electronics manufacturer Foxconn could face an uncertain future following this week's nail-biter of a midterm election. In a narrow win over incumbent Governor Scott Walker, Democrat Tony Evers will have at least some say in what happens next as Foxconn starts building its new LCD screen factory near Racine. In his campaign, Evers had criticized the deal, noting environmental concerns and a low return on investment for the state. Our next guest is with us to talk about what might happen with the deal now that Evers is governor-elect. Ricardo Torres is a reporter with the Journal Times. He covers federal, state, and Racine County politics, along with the village of Mount Pleasant. Ricardo, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Well, I know the governor doesn't have complete power over this deal. How much could change in a Foxconn deal with now a different governor?
Well, I think with Tony Evers coming in, one of the big things that I'm going to be looking into is to see how state oversight is going to play a role in this development. Right now, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation that was the main state agency that kind of brought Foxconn to Wisconsin, and they're also the ones who are in charge of verifying tax credits. The deal between the state and Foxconn is almost $3 billion, but Foxconn doesn't get those tax incentives without meeting certain goals. So, for example, if they wanted to hire 5,000 people, they could get X amount of tax credits, and the WEDC is the state agency that is in charge of verifying that. Now, what Tony Evers has told me in the past is that he plans to disband the WEDC, citing other previous issues in the past, and put in, he says, a different state agency that he hopes would run a lot better, a lot smoother than the WEDC. So right now we're kind of in wait and see mode to see if Tony Evers follows through in disbanding the WEDC or if there are some other changes, maybe some other things going on internally. Okay. So that's one area. I think another area is with the DNR. Foxconn has faced a lot of criticisms on environmental regulations and things like that, and Governor Walker wasn't necessarily the friendliest governor to the DNR in Wisconsin, so we'll have to wait and see what Tony Evers does when it comes to the DNR and building it back up and what type of oversight that they will have over the project.
Now, as a candidate, Tony Evers talked about Foxconn in debates, and here he is in a radio ad from the Evers campaign.
Have you heard the saying, it's too good to be true? It probably is. Well, the Donald Trump, Scott Walker $3 billion deal for Foxconn might sound good until you look at the fine print. For starters, did you know that the Trump-Walker deal will take Wisconsin taxpayers 25 years just to break even? That means a kid born today could graduate from college by the time we might see a nickel on their return for our investment. But worse, those promised Foxconn jobs aren't even required to be jobs for Wisconsin residents. Contractors that build the facilities aren't required to be Wisconsin contractors. And the deal would exempt Foxconn from critical environmental protections. Sounds good for Foxconn, but what's in it for the rest of us? Just think if we invested that money in our schools instead. I'm Tony Evers, and I'm running for governor because we need a new approach that will grow the economy for the middle class and invest in our Wisconsin workers and our future. And that's why Tony for Wisconsin paid for this ad.
So that's the case he made on Foxconn. Talk about that job angle. Is this maybe an opportunity for a governor to try to hold Foxconn's feet to the fire and have more of those jobs guaranteed to come from Wisconsin itself?
Certainly, Tony Evers probably hopes that more jobs go to Wisconsin workers. I know just from the contracts that were signed between the state and Foxconn that there's a promise of at a minimum 6,500 jobs, half the jobs, to remain in Racine County. Now, whether or not those jobs go to Racine County residents is another story. So when it comes to the jobs and who gets the jobs, Foxconn has been very forward in trying to recruit people from the state, but they've also been trying to go to other places outside the state to bring people to Wisconsin. That was one thing Governor Walker said on the campaign trail, is that more people are coming to Wisconsin because of jobs like Foxconn, or, you know, locating, hopefully, he hoped, locating businesses in southeastern Wisconsin to lure some talent, some technology talent that, you know, comes as like a ripple effect of Foxconn coming. So I think Tony Evers wants to make sure that the most Wisconsin residents get these jobs, but it's kind of on the company to decide who they want to hire.
Talking to Ricardo Torres from the Journal Times. He covers Racine County, among other things. We're talking about the possible impact on the Foxconn deal of Tony Evers' election as governor. Ricardo, through the campaign, there were surveys and other ways trying to gauge what people around the state thought of this Foxconn deal, how it might affect their vote. You are on the ground there. What are people in Racine County, in the area where Foxconn is coming in, saying? Do they view this as a big positive for the community?
Foxconn in Racine County and kind of around the state is kind of a Rorschach test. You kind of look at Foxconn and you see what you want to see. In Racine County, has had the highest unemployment rate for almost 30 years. So there are people and businesses struggling here who look at Foxconn as kind of like a win, like finally Racine County, you know, gets a break. There are other people, though, in Mount Pleasant who see Foxconn coming in and residents being forced to take money to leave their homes. And some people are willing and wanting to sell their land, sell their property to the village for that then to be turned over to Foxconn. Other people haven't been so happy to do that. And there were people that I talked to who said that they moved out to Mount Pleasant because Mount Pleasant has some rural areas and they wanted to be out in the country. And now with Foxconn coming, it's going to be the complete opposite of that. So they're going to have to move and, you know, to find that life again. And so Foxconn is kind of a mixed bag when it comes to just how people feel. People are happy about jobs coming into the area. You know, not everybody's super psyched about just all the construction that's going to be going on and roads being closed and things like that, you know, to accommodate for this company. So it's kind of lots of mixed opinions, mixed feelings in the area when it comes to Foxconn.
And Ricardo, I sometimes talk about Foxconn in the future tense, but groundbreaking actually happened some months back. What is actually happening? What is underway? What are you seeing around there?
So they're starting to actually build physical buildings. You know, some vertical panels went up. I was at a ceremony several weeks back, kind of highlighting the fact that they're actually building something on the property. For a lot of the area, they're still kind of clearing stuff out, making sure that the ground has a nice foundation for them to build upon and kind of just lay out their blueprints and their ideas for the future. And there's a multi-purpose building not too far away from the Foxconn site where the company kind of has its, like, offices of, like, operation and things like that, where they're continuing to work on products and kind of change as technology changes, because this facility is not going to be ready to go for another couple years. And as everyone knows with technology changes from year to year. And so Foxconn sees that as like something that they need to be on top of. They can't be operating with old technology. They can't be producing old technology. So they have this multi-purpose building in order to stay on top of the latest technology trends.
Ricardo, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob. It's great to be here.
That was Ricardo Torres, reporter with the Journal Times. He covers federal, state, and Racine County politics, along with the village of Mount Pleasant. He was with us today to talk about the future of the Foxconn deal under Governor-elect Tony Evers. An experimental cancer treatment called precision medicine is getting a lot of buzz in the medical community and the media. But despite that, it's still a largely unproven treatment. For many patients, it comes with a high price tag. Liz Szabo is a senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News. She's been following this procedure, precision medicine. Liz, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be here.
Well, Liz, I'd heard the phrase precision medicine until I read your reporting on it. I didn't really get what it was. Can you talk us through what we mean by that?
Sure. Well, you're right to be confused because it's sort of a shifting definition depending on what people mean or want to get from it. But in my article, and I think what most people mean is when people have advanced cancer and they may be out of standard options, doctors can order up pretty expensive tests that actually look into the genetic mutations and variations in their own cancer and then try to find drugs that have been designed for those mutations. Rate of success in that situation is really pretty low, but a lot of patients are seeking it out because they are pretty desperate.
Right. It's a last resort for people, at least as it's used now.
In a lot of cases. It's been proven to work pretty well in lung cancer and in melanoma, a dangerous skin cancer. And it's actually even become, those kinds of tests of looking for specific mutations have actually become the standard of care in those cancers. For most patients, though, with a lot of the common cancers like breast, ovarian, prostate cancer, it really hasn't been proven to save lives yet.
And this is the big hope of genomic medicine, right? We've untangled the human genome. We can go, we can find the genes linked to certain conditions like cancers. But the treatments haven't really kept up with that, right? We're trying medications, but it's kind of guesswork for some of these cancers, it almost seems like.
In some cases, yes, there are commercial tests that doctors can order that cost $5,000 or $6,000 if you don't have insurance. And they can look for 300 or more genetic variations in your tumor. But the big bottleneck here is that there are only really a couple dozen targeted therapies. So they can find lots of things that are wrong, but they often can't do anything about it.
In your reporting, it seems like one of the big problems here is a mismatch between hope and hype on the one hand and the actual performance on the other. Can you talk about the good news we keep hearing about it that maybe overlooks some of the downsides?
Yeah, it's really tough when people have advanced cancer and they don't have a lot of options. In our story, I interviewed someone with advanced breast cancer, and the typical survival there is maybe around 3 years. She had a little 8-year-old girl, so that didn't seem like enough to her. So she went looking for these genetic tests. And she is one of the really rare successes. Doctors were able to find lots of mutations, and not just mutations, but ones that they could actually match her to a drug with. So doctors were able to find some drugs, and she seems to be doing pretty well. We don't know if that's because of the drugs. She's not really being compared to another patient in a trial, but at least for her right now, she's doing well.
But you also follow the story of another patient who did not survive after trying precision medicine.
Yeah. We wrote a story about a really wonderful woman who had multiple biopsies of her lungs and of her liver, of her blood. She gave precision medicine everything she could, and it wasn't enough for her. It never found her a drug that she wouldn't have tried anyway or that wasn't too toxic to bear. So I think it's an exciting field, and I think it's a field with that people are hoping, have really high hopes for. But right now, it's important for patients to know that unless they have lung cancer or melanoma, that precision medicine is still very much experimental.
Talking to Liz Szabo, senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News, about the hopes for precision medicine and cancer treatment and the limitations. And let's get into the costs a little bit, Liz. Talk about the kind of expenses involved for a cancer patient who is pursuing precision medicine.
Sure. Well, cancer is outrageously expensive under the best circumstances. New drugs routinely debut at over $100,000 a year. Now, some people may think, well, I've got really good insurance. The woman in my story, Kristen Kilmer, has really good insurance. However, because the drugs that she ended up taking with precision medicine were not the standard drugs for her type of breast cancer, her insurance company viewed them as experimental. And really, in a lot of cases, precision medicine really is experimental. We don't have really good data on it yet. So that meant, because they viewed it as experimental, that she would have to pay for all of it herself. Now, she was luckier than a lot of people. She appealed to drug companies for financial assistance. When that ran out, though, she was looking at either paying $17,000 a month for a drug that she thought was really helping her, or just going off the drug. And she chose to go off the drug. And after our story came out, the drug company offered her the drug for free. But the problem is that she really thought the drug was helping, but she said, I can't bankrupt my family. I have a little girl. I have a husband. I can't leave them in the kind of debt that would prevent my daughter from going to college just to get a few more months or years.
Why aren't people using the drugs in this way part of actual experiments? These are, as you say, still in an experimental stage in a lot of ways. Wouldn't these people be the perfect subjects for testing these drugs for possible future use?
That's a great question. There are actually two really important clinical trials of this kind of precision medicine going on. One is run by the National Cancer Institute. One is run by the American Society for Clinical Oncology. And those are really good trials, and patients in those trials do get the drugs for free. However, most clinical trials take place in the big city. So in Wisconsin, a patient might be able to get on a clinical trial in Madison or Milwaukee, or they might have to go to Chicago, or they might have to go to Washington. These trials aren't always where the patients are. It can be really expensive and exhausting to get to the clinical trials. Honestly, even just affording these tests can be expensive. Medicare does pay for the tests if you're 65 and older, and if you're on Medicare. If you have private insurance, they mostly don't pay for these tests. So one of the women I interviewed opened up her mail and found a bill for $5,800 for a test she just assumed would be covered, and it was not covered.
Looking toward the future, right now it sounds like a cancer patient has their genetic code tested and then they're matched up with existing drugs. Is there a hope that we can test cancer patients to help develop new drugs that might be targeted at particular, DNA setups?
Yeah, absolutely. And the problem is just that the drug development process is very long. The vast majority of cancer drugs don't make it. They may look good in a test tube or in a mouse, and they just don't work in real life. So we do know about hundreds and hundreds of possible mutations in cancer, and I think drug companies are definitely looking at some of the most promising mutations and trying to develop drugs that would work in those really specific cases. It's just a long, slow process, and it's slower than any of us want it to be.
And I know when we say the word cancer, we're talking about a lot of different cancers, plural, different causes. Mm-hmm. In a lot of cases, it might just be a gene. It might be something environmental. It might be an interaction between both. Does that make it a really hard target to come up with this kind of treatment for this many different kinds of cancers?
You know what's really tough is that cancer is really several hundred diseases, really. And even in something like breast cancer or lung cancer, doctors can now break those out into different kinds of lung cancer, different kinds of breast cancer, depending on the genetic makeup. And there are some cancers caused by really rare mutations, and there have been drugs that have been found that work amazingly well. But these are mutations that might affect 1% or 2% of the population. So it can be hard to find those patients. It can take years just to enroll enough for a clinical trial. And then trying to have a successful business model for a drug that treats so few patients can be tough. If you've got a really great drug, but it took 10 years to develop or 20 years to develop, and now you can only sell it to 5,000 people, that's tough. It can be hard to convince drug companies to make a drug for such a rare disease.
Looking at the state of the art right now, do you get a sense more that, okay, this is a promising treatment and it's going to keep getting better in the future, or we've got the low-hanging fruit, now we've hit a roadblock, maybe not much more is going to come anytime soon?
That's a great question about low-hanging fruit. There tends to be a lot of hope and hype in cancer, and people get really excited about something that's promising, and it does work on some of the low-hanging fruit. And when people try it against other types of cancers, the treatments, for example, immunotherapy or drugs that stopped cancers from recruiting new blood vessels, these have all been really hot fields. And sometimes they do work really well on, as you said, the low-hanging fruit, and then it can be tough to find something that works for everyone. It seems like the way we make progress in cancer, and scientists are definitely making progress, is sort of inch by inch, and everyone hopes that we'd be making progress by leaps and bounds, but it just rarely seems to work that way.
Liz, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Liz Szabo, senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News. She was with us to talk about the high costs and uncertain outcomes of precision medicine in cancer treatment. A little over 10 years ago, our guest looked at her everyday life and decided she wasn't as happy as maybe she could be. She, like many of us, felt she had ideas of what she'd one day do, like learn Photoshop, read more, have more fun, but that one day wasn't coming. She realized what many of us know but still struggle to put into action, that her life wasn't going to change unless she decided to do something about it. And that's how she started the Happiness Project. Gretchen Rubin blogs about happiness and has a podcast called Happier with Gretchen Rubin. She's the author of many books, including The Four Tendencies and Better Than Before. Today, she's joining us to talk about the 10th anniversary of her book, The Happiness Project, or Why I Spent a Year Trying to Sing in the Morning, Clean My Closets, Fight Right, Read Aristotle, and Generally Have More Fun. Gretchen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be talking to you.
Me too. Well, remind us how you tackled this idea of being, you know, a little bit happier day by day.
Well, I decided to do a happiness project, and I decided it would be a year long because it seemed like a year was long enough to allow for real change, but also not so interminable that I would feel overwhelmed. And so I gave each month a theme, like energy or friendship, and then for each theme I came up with a handful of manageable concrete resolutions that I thought would make me happier in that area. And then I did them to see, well, can you make yourself happier? Could I make myself happier? And that was my happiness project.
A lot of people, I think, might have that long-term view. I will be happy when I fill in the blank, graduate, get a good job, retire, whatever that might be. And you tried to break it down into bits and pieces. What's the value of playing, I guess, in baseball terms, small ball with happiness?
Right. Well, what you're talking about is the arrival fallacy, the idea that people have this thought, well, if I just did arrive at a certain point, then I will automatically become happier. But often when we arrive at that point, we've already kind of gotten adjusted to it by the time it happens. So we don't get, you don't sort of all of a sudden cross some finish line and become happy. I think you're right. It's more about doing the little things, thinking about, well, today, tomorrow, next month, next year, are these the things that make me happier? Would I be happier if I figured out a way to read more? Would I be happier if I figured out a way to get more sleep? Would I be happier if I found a way to see my friends more regularly? And the fact is, for a lot of us, there is a lot of low-hanging fruit. There's a lot of things we can do without spending a lot of time, energy, or money, which are, for most people, in short supply, that really do, over the long term, give you a very significant happiness boost.
Let's dig into a couple of those that you just mentioned, because I think they're ones that a lot of people might relate to. Part of adult life for a lot of people, myself included, is, yeah, you don't see, or many of us don't see our friends as often as we might like. How did you tackle that and try to make time and follow through with that idea?
No, and you're exactly right, because one of the things, one of the most common complaints for adults is that they don't see their friends, or they, like maybe they've moved someplace and they don't have the friends that they once had, and so they have to figure out how to make new friends. Well, one thing I realized is that you need to show up, and that when people have a new baby, or they're having an open house, or there's going to be like a happy hour at work. Part of it is that you really have to say to yourself, this is something that's going to make me happier. It's really worth my time and my energy. Even something like really saying a hello to somebody as you're walking into the office in the morning instead of just like staying glued to your screen. In the end, anything that deepens our relationships or broadens our relationships is going to be happier. And for relationships, you really, really do need to show up. One thing that I did that was sort of funny, and it's funny because it seems kind of calculating to put a number on it, but what I do now is when I'm entering into a new situation, like I'm going to have a new work relationship, or when my daughters were younger, when they would go to a new school, I would say, okay, my aim here is to make 3 new friends. So I was looking I'm meeting all these people at once. I'm like, okay, I need 3. How are you going to help me get to 3? Because what I realized is that it's easy to get into this thing where you're sort of like, you seem nice, but you don't really push it towards a friendship. Whereas if you're like, I really want to make a friend, it made me much more conscious of really trying to reach out to somebody and trying to turn it into a friendship, which is, it's kind of funny to like have a numerical target, but it really helped me to make new friends.
Talking to Gretchen Rubin, talking about the 10th anniversary of the release of her book, The Happiness Project, and ways we can be a little bit happier day by day. And Gretchen, with that example and so many others from your book and your blog, a lot of it seems to come down to some effort up front to establish habits that do the things that are going to make us happier.
Absolutely. And in fact, after writing The Happiness Project and then Happier at Home, which was a happiness project that focused on home, I wrote a whole book called Better Than Before, all about habits, because you're exactly right. As I talked to more and more people and thought more and more about my own happiness, I realized a lot of the things that I wanted to do to be happier really were things that had to do with habits. Like, I wanted to exercise, not just like train for the marathon, but exercise regularly forever, not just give up sugar for Lent, but eat healthfully forever. Not just read, I'm going to read, 10 books in 6 months or whatever, but I just want to do a lot of reading all forever. And so the way to do that is to work on your habits, because habits, then you put a behavior on automatic pilot. You don't have to use willpower. You don't have to use self-control. You don't have to make decisions. And so understanding how to work on your habits makes it a lot easier to do the things that you know are going to make you happier, healthier, more productive, or more creative. But you have to, as you say, put the work in up front to build those things into your life in a regular way.
I wonder how you've dealt through all of this with unhappiness, because we can't be happy all the time. And I think sometimes people who have set a goal of happiness, if they're unhappy, it's even worse, because it's like, I'm supposed to be happy and I'm failing. How do you deal with the down moments that everybody's going to have?
Well, that's a great point. And I think, to have a life where you are perfectly happy all the time, it's not realistic, and I don't think it would even be a good life, because obviously there are times where it's absolutely appropriate to feel angry or bored or very sad or resentful. And in fact, these negative emotions are really, really helpful, because what they do is they show us that something in our life needs to change. If we never had experienced negative emotions, then we might not, if you didn't feel guilty, then you might not behave yourself as well. And so these negative emotions are really useful as long as we take them into account and think, well, given the information that I'm getting about myself, what can I do differently to make myself happier? For example, envy is a very painful emotion. People don't like to feel envious. It's almost like an embarrassing thing to feel, but envy is a really helpful emotion to feel, because what it shows you is that somebody has something that you want. And so the question is, okay, well, if you're really envious of this person because they go on all these great trips, is there a way that you could travel more within your own circumstances? Because you want something they have, and maybe that's a helpful thing for you to know. Or if you're sad, part of loving someone and feeling attached is feeling sad if something happens to them. Of course, that's part of the range of emotions.
So the same skills we develop and habit setting that we might do to get a little happier day by day and do the things that make us happy might also help us figure out the meaning of the things that make us unhappy?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think for all of us, the question is not like how can I be perfectly happy all the time, but it's, given my nature and my circumstances, am I as happy as I can be? So, you know, like, let's say your mother's in the hospital. Of course you're going to be sad, you're going to be worried, but it's like, okay, given that I'm in that circumstance, can I do the things that are going to help me be as happy as I can be? Because I'll probably manage the situation better. If I wear myself out, if I stay up all night, if I never eat, if I, you know, never give myself any relief, I'm probably going to burn myself out and run myself ragged and kind of get to be a wreck. Whereas if I say, okay, I need to give myself breaks, I need to make sure I get enough sleep, I need to make sure that I eat regularly, that's going to help us stay energized and be able to manage, you know, have the emotional wherewithal that we need to deal with a troubling situation.
We're talking to Gretchen Rubin, author, blogger, and podcaster, on the subject of happiness. We're talking about what she's learned in the 10 years since her book, The Happiness Project, was published. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have ways of doing some of the things Gretchen's talking about, finding time, finding motivation to do the things that ultimately make you happier? Maybe not perfectly happy, but a little happier. And have you tried some of Gretchen's advice over the years from her books or blogs or podcast? Or do you have a question for Gretchen? Do you need some advice on how to put this into action? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. We're talking to Gretchen Rubin. It's the 10th anniversary of her book, The Happiness Project. She blogs and has a podcast as well on the subject of happiness. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you found a way to be a little happier in your day-to-day life? What did you do? How did you think about it? How did you motivate yourself? If you've used Gretchen's advice over the years from her many books, from her blog or podcast, love to hear from you. Or if you have a question for Gretchen, we'd love to hear from you about that too. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. So Gretchen, we talked about how you, in part, were developing habits. Do you feel like for you, they took the stuff you started doing 10 plus years ago? It's just, you know, it's stuff you do without thinking about it now?
Absolutely, absolutely. But it's funny, in Better Than Before, I developed this personality framework that divides people into four personality types, and then I wrote a whole book about it called The Four Tendencies, and one of the things I learned from that process is I'm the kind of person who finds it pretty easy to form habits. So that was like an insight that I had backwards, which is, oh, I see why it was pretty easy for me to make and stick to these resolutions, because turns out I'm an upholder, and that's the kind of person who finds it pretty easy to form habits.
Yeah, you talked to us a while back about the four tendencies. I remember there was one group, I think you called them the rebels, where don't tell me what to do. The rules, even if maybe the rules I'm trying to set for myself, the existence of rules makes me want to push back. I don't want to do stuff even if it's for my own good. How does that quarter of the population do good stuff for themselves?
Well, there even few. There aren't an equal number of all the tendencies.
Oh, okay.
That even they're not even 25%. Well, for rebels, because they resist outer and inner expectations, the way they can do what they want to do is first they can think about their identity. They do it because, hey, I do this because I'm an athlete. I do this because I'm a strong, vital person, and I want to take care of my body. I love being outside. That's how they might get themselves to do something like exercise, or, you know, I'm an artist. I want to put my work out into the world. That's why I'm going to paint every day. And then they can also think about the consequences of doing something or not doing something. I'm doing my physical therapy exercises, not because the doctor told me to, but because I want to be pain-free and independent. Like, I don't want the consequences of not doing it, so even though I don't want to, I'm going to suck it up and do it because that's what I want.
Can they, like, imagine or think about a real nemesis in their lives and think, ha, everything I do good for myself is sticking it to them?
That might, because they do often love a challenge, like, oh, you think an old guy like me can't quit smoking? I'll show you. So if you're like, if they were thinking of it, some nemesis, and they're like, oh, that person thinks I can't run the marathon in 2019. Well, I will do it. But if people are curious about this, they can take a quiz at quiz.gretchenrubin.com. And I think 1.7 million people now have taken this free quiz. If someone's like, huh, am I a rebel? Or an upholder. I'm an upholder. That's my tendency.
I don't remember what I was. I took the test. I wasn't a rebel, strangely. I don't know. Even though my catchphrase is, don't tell me what to do.
Weren't you a questioner?
I think I was.
It's good. I think you were a questioner.
So I'm in a good job because I mostly ask questions.
That's good.
Now, since you came out with the first book and the other books, you've had a lot of interaction with your readers through your website, back and forth, I assume, responses to your blog and podcast. What kind of creative things have you heard from your fans about things they've done to adapt your advice in their own lives?
Oh, we've gotten so many fantastic ideas. One of the best ideas that we got was from a listener who suggested, a lot of times people, it's new year, new you, people want to make New Year's resolutions, but then for a lot of people that sort of doesn't appeal. Either they're not successful, or it just doesn't appeal to them as a way. But something that really caught people's attention was the idea of doing 18 for 2018, or now we would do 19 for 2019, which is to make a list of things, and they could be tiny, like try every ice cream at my local ice cream shop, or it could be something big like renovate the basement or switch careers. But you make a list, and then the idea is that as time goes through, as the year rolls on, you try to cross as many things off the list as you can. And the funny thing about this list is that people seem to have much more fun with it than they do with a typical New Year's resolution list or handful of things people do for New Year's resolutions. And it seems to unleash something in them that it makes it more fun to tackle things that have been kind of weighing on them for years. I don't know why it is doing it in this form. Seems to be much more playful and fun for people, but this was something that really caught their attention. And our attention, Elizabeth, my co-host Elizabeth, my sister and I, both really got into 18 for 2018. another thing that we talked about on the podcast that I think was my idea, but that people really loved, was to choose a signature color. This is just kind of whimsical and silly, but it's like, what's your, and then if you're buying a cell phone case or, an exercise mat or something, you use your signature color. And people just got very fired up about their signature colors. It's just something silly and fun to make your day a little more joyful.
Talking to Gretchen Rubin, author of The Happiness Project, among other books. You can check out her podcast, Happier with Gretchen Rubin. She's helping us be a little happier. Now, in that list of those 18 for 2018, there's the try the ice cream flavors, okay, doable and fun. Find a new career. Okay, so if we have this big goal like this, it's easy to say words like, I'm going to make this big change in my life. How do we, operationalize something like that?
Well, I think the thing always to do with whatever we're trying to do is to think about concrete, manageable steps. Because you're right, it's easy to stay very abstract and so big that it just kind of vanishes into the clouds, whether it's something like choose a new career or something like enjoy the moment. You're like, what does that even mean? So for a lot of people, it's helpful to really break it down into steps so that you can see, okay, this is manageable, step by step. This is the order of things. Maybe I'm going to go through and, like, if I need to make phone calls, I'm going to fill in those phone numbers now, or I'm going to find those addresses or those URLs now, and so that when I'm ready, I can just execute. I don't have to waste a lot of time. Now, when people talk about habits or they talk about something like choosing a new career, they often say that you should keep it, like, very, very small steps. And that's the way people do best. What I will say from my experience is that's true for some people, and like they want to make small steps, like do one thing every day, or like try, instead, if you want to exercise more, go around the block one time and then kind of build. That's great advice for some people, but some people want to go big or go home. They want to do something transformative all at once. They get kind of bored and lose interest if they're making incremental change. So if you feel like you want to take a week vacation and like blow it out and like rethink your entire career in that week, don't have anybody tell you that that's the wrong way to do it. You should do it in the way that's right for you. Some people like to do a little bit over the long term. Some people like to just really, really focus and do something in a big way. And there's no right way or wrong way. It's just whatever works for you as you're approaching something that you're trying to get done.
Well, here's someone looking for some advice. Rio emails, should I take a job that pays well but that I don't enjoy so I can shorten the overall amount of time I have to work, or should I find a job I'm interested in but may pay poorly? Well, there's a lot of detail we're not getting into there, but broad strokes, Gretchen, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think this is kind of a false choice because it isn't a situation where there are two jobs in the world. One of these jobs hasn't even been defined. What is this second job? I think the thing to do is to say, do I have to choose? Maybe I can find a job that pays well and that I do enjoy. Sometimes we, to make our lives simpler, we kind of try to distill it into like one is A and one is B and never the twain shall meet. But very often we can have A and B. And especially since this isn't a, this doesn't sound like it's a choice between two options. It's a choice between two theoretical options, in which case, in practice, there might be something that's, that you're not anticipating. So I think don't try to decide up front what you want, but to go look for the job that you really desire.
Also raises the issue of deferring happiness. The assumption here is that I'll be done working, and then I'll be retired, and then I'll be happy, which maybe isn't the way to approach the problem.
Right. Well, again, it's the arrival fallacy. It's like, oh, if, as long as I get there. Yeah, but one of my I have 12 personal commandments that I write about in the Happiness Project, and one is from my father, who always says, enjoy the process. And the problem is with life, we never know how things are going to end up. We don't know if we're going to achieve our aim or if we're even going to reach our aim. Like, stuff happens all the time. But if you enjoy the process, then you've been happy along the way. And so it's very important to enjoy the process. Life is much happier if you enjoy the process. Now, of course, financial security is something that's very, very valuable. I would never say that it's not an important factor in happiness, because certainly one of the greatest luxuries that money buys is the freedom from having to worry about money. So it's not that there's no place for that in thinking about, well, what do I want my life to be going forward? But you don't want to just say, like, well, this, I have to think about this in isolation, and that should trump every other value, because all these things are connected to each other.
Let me hit you in our last couple of minutes, Gretchen, with I think something that probably a lot of people feel, especially in the digital age. We spend time, I spend time, you know, I'm looking at news articles on the phone and then look at something on the computer and do this and that, frittering away time. And looking back, I'm like, that didn't make me happier. How can we jog ourselves out of that and consciously do something that we enjoy?
Well, that is so important, and people talk about that all the time. And I think to remember that technology is a great servant, but it's a bad master. And we have to reassert, you know, we are the boss of technology. And so I think it's to really be mindful of, like, when is it that I tend to fritter my time away, or when do I see that I'm spending time in ways that in the end don't make me happy? And maybe that's turning off notifications. Maybe it's turning your phone to grayscale so that it's in black, white, and gray, so it's much less appealing. Maybe it's literally putting it in away from you, like on a high shelf behind a closed door for certain hours of the day, so that you can't get to it unless there's sort of an emergency. Maybe there's apps that you want to delete from your phone, so you have to only use it on desktop because you think, well, I'm not going to check it on desktop all the time. Or maybe you delete it on desktop and only check it on your phone, depending on how you use it. But I think the thing to do is to really remember that we are the masters of this, and not to just default into whatever it is that is being offered to us, but really to think, what do I want to get out of this? There are many, many wonderful, valuable things that can come to us through technology, as long as we use it mindfully. And remember that everything has an opportunity cost. And so if you're spending hours scrolling through a news feed, then that may be a novel that you're not reading, and you'd rather be reading the novel.
Guilty.
So figure it out. Yeah, there you go, right?
Gretchen, thanks a lot. It's always fun to talk to you.
Thank you.
Gretchen Rubin blogs about happiness and has a podcast called Happier with Gretchen Rubin. She's the author of books including The Four Tendencies, Better Than Before. She joins today to talk about the 10th anniversary of the book that started a lot of it. It's called The Happiness Project. You could still email your happiness stories, ideas@WPR.org. We had a conversation about snail mail a couple weeks back, actually sending handwritten letters to people. Since then, I've gotten some handwritten mail from you, from listeners. A couple more came in over the last few days. Dave in Platteville sent a postcard. Dear sir, he writes, and usually when I get mail that starts that way, the next words are please cease and desist. But Dave says, thanks for the recent segment about print snail mail. I began my postcard addiction years ago during a vacation. Now I use them for thank you purposes and special fun greetings. Dave sent that on a postcard with a landscape of Platteville with that big M off in the distance. I also got a letter from Christopher in Rhinelander. Christopher says he's a pen pal for many people. He writes, I correspond with several people, which is a lot of fun. I really enjoy getting to know people. And he says, I do text with a few of them, but I find letters to be more enjoyable. Thanks, Dave and Christopher. I'm in a bit of a quandary. I want to write back. And I was talking to my wife about it, and she said, you can't write it yourself. Because she knows, and I know, I have the writing of an elementary school kid who is not good at writing, which is what I was as an elementary school kid. My report cards, we had the S's and U's in lower elementary, satisfactory, unsatisfactory, S-S-S-S-S-S, U for handwriting. My writing is illegible, but I don't want to type something. I don't want to dictate because that's just weird. So letter writers, thank you. I'll figure out a plan and get back to you, but thank you so much for writing in. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.